This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. I'm here at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, where much, of course, is happening on the convention floor and in the caucus rooms and between delegates. But of course, this convention is being held in the city of Philadelphia, a historic city, a very important city, and a city that has issues of its own. Joining me today is retired Philadelphia police Captain Ray Lewis. Welcome to the program, Mr. Lewis.
Thanks, Sonali, for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first of all, before we get into some of the issues that are important to you and your story, which is really fascinating, what do you make of the circus that has come into your town?
Well, it's like any other political circus. The media is only covering everything that's hunky-dory. They're not showing the thousands and thousands of people who are protesting outside.
On the one hand, you have the history, you have the museums, you have the beautiful architecture, you have the wealth, but then you have the social ills that go along with many big cities, many diverse cities. You've got poverty, you've got struggles, you've got labor issues, you've got people, demanding to be paid a bigger wage. And there's also a lot of grassroots activism here. How do you want, for example, the Democratic National Convention attendees, those who are new to Philadelphia, to view the city? Because most people aren't stepping outside the perimeter of the Wells Fargo Center or this downtown city center. What would you like them to know about your city, the one that you presided over as police captain for many, many years, to see it in its fullness, good and bad?
Well, the one thing I think where Philadelphia is very unique in that they really have some very interesting, diverse neighborhoods. This is not a Houston or a Dallas, Miami. This has many different types of neighborhoods, founded some by the Italians, the Germans, the Irish, and they were different in structure, they're different in architecture. Although these people won't be able to see those neighborhoods, that to me is where Philadelphia really distinguishes itself. They're not going to see any of the problems in this city that affect every major city, and that is rich people pulled out, and they left the cities to disintegrate.
Let's focus on that for a little bit. When you say the rich people pulled out, how has Philadelphia's economy suffered, and what impact has that had on low-wage workers? I know that around the country there's this Fight for 15 campaign, and Philadelphia workers have joined in with them, fast food workers, etc. How have people suffered from the poverty left behind by the bankers? But how are they fighting back?
Well, unfortunately, they can't fight back. They're disenfranchised. The only thing they can do is vote. That's the only power they have. And they don't feel that makes a damn, because they've done that and that doesn't work. If you want to see Philadelphia, what it really happened, we have an elevated train. We have train on the ground, we have underground train, but we also have an elevated train. Ride that from beginning to end and look out the window. You will see warehouse, factory after warehouse, after factory abandoned all the way to the end. These once were factories that gave meaningful purpose and money and pensions and health care to workers in Philadelphia. That's when it was thriving. That's where I grew up. My father had a pension. My father had health care. All my neighbors, they had these kind of jobs. The rich people, and they are so rich, billionaires, but once you have billions of dollars and you want to make more money still, you're a sociopath. You don't care that your workers have health care. You don't care if you pay them the minimum wage. And what they realized is, hey, if we take these union jobs down south where there were no unions, we can make maybe a million or two more in the next year to pad to our billions. Then they go down south and they realize with new technology, you know what? If we ship these jobs overseas, we can make another million. They don't care what happens to people. They have no heart. They're sociopaths. Sociopaths have no remorse, they feel no guilt, and they can always justify what they do. So taking away all these jobs, all these pensions, all this health care has destroyed every major city in America.
Including Philadelphia. So this, of course, is the most important, or I would say most commonly felt issue during this election year, and it is what has propelled the candidacies of Bernie Sanders, which of course now is no longer a candidacy. It's just on yesterday and on Tuesday, the nomination of the Democratic Party formally went to Hillary Clinton. And of course, the GOP has already picked Donald Trump, whose slogan is Make America Great Again, you know, which there's so many ways to parse that sentence and critique that sentence. However, both of the two candidates, Trump and Sanders, seem to have tapped into this deeply. Sanders, when he was a candidate,
go ahead.
Tapped into this deep-seated anger and disgust with our economic system. Now, of course, we're left between with a choice between Trump and Hillary, a billionaire and a neoliberal economic politician. And both of them are making promises, but how do we believe them? Because, you know, ultimately, aren't Trump and Clinton both speaking for the 1% and not the 99%?
Absolutely. I don't even have to address Trump or Hillary, in my opinion, because they're nothing but the 1%. But I will quickly address Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders disappointed many of us when he joined the system by endorsing Hillary. I saw his acceptance speech. I was nauseous. The way he lauded. I'm sorry. His speech supporting Hillary Clinton. I could not believe he was raving about. If she was so wonderful, why didn't he support her from the very beginning? The man made a mockery. Bernie Sanders made a mockery of every single one of us, millions of people who supported him. People who broke their piggy banks, emptied their cookie jars to send him $5, $10, $15. People who stayed up into the wee hours of the morning creating signs, banners, puppets to march in hundreds of Bernie parades around the country because of this. He was offered the presidential nomination for the Green Party by Jill Stein. He declined it. He could have proved that he bowed to the people and not bowed to the system. When he declined that offer, he told me all I needed to know about him. He was not really outside this system. He's an inherent part of the system because he had it made. Number one, he would have got almost all of the independent vote, which is the biggest group of people, and it's growing. I mean, it's the most rapidly growing part of our electorate there is. Number two, he would have got all the people that were dissatisfied with Trump or Hillary, they would have went to him. The people who were they abhorred, the Democrats and Republicans who abhorred their nominees, he would have benefited from them by staying home. And he would have had an organization that is already on the ground and running, the Green Party. And he refused that. No time for him anymore either.
So then what? I mean, obviously, voting and elections are a very small part of how change happens, right? The least thing that you can do to change your country or to be participating in your political process is to go on election day and cast a ballot. It takes just a few minutes to do it. The most important work happens outside elections, right? How do you see that continuing? Do you see those people who supported Bernie Sanders giving up in disgust and saying, I'm going to go home and, you know, just go back to watching TV because nothing I do will make a difference? Or, as Sanders hopes and many others hopes, this idea of a political revolution continuing past the election?
No, most of Bernie Sanders' supporters are going to feel, I trusted this guy totally, and I was stabbed in the back again. Mm. Again. You're trusting somebody, a politician, and they turn on you. Bernie Sanders had first of all, there's half of this country is not registered to vote. He would have had millions of people going door to door to get people registered to vote. No other candidate in history had the grassroots excitement and enthusiasm that Bernie generated. He could have had 50% of this these unregistered voters registered, because people would have hit the streets for him, just like they have been doing, and he blew it. He threw that grassroots power away. And so you're going to have a lot of people who say, you know, I sent him my money, I stayed up late, I did this, I did that. For what? For supporting Hillary Clinton? you got to be crazy.
Finally, Ray Lewis, I'm wondering what you hope or what sort of message you have, particularly for young people. You referred earlier to anybody under the age of 50 as being a kid to you. You're an interesting person with an interesting background, a former police captain, now an activist. You sort of straddle different fields and intersect different fields. You have views that align with a lot of ordinary people, but not necessarily align with people in power. Can activism, can there be political change? Do you feel like in your lifetime we're going to see grassroots attempts like Occupy Wall Street, like Black Lives Matter, like many other efforts, climate justice activists, et cetera, start to make a positive difference in this country? And how do you keep from giving up?
Well, what keeps me from giving up, and I hope what keeps everyone from giving up, is what do we turn to? Do we just
fight or die?
Yeah, fight or die. I don't see us having an option to give up. But these type of things make it incredibly difficult to continue.
What period were you the police captain in Philadelphia, and when did you retire?
I was a police captain from 1999 to 2004. I started out as a patrol officer, as everyone does, and I spent 10 years in the belly of the beast before I made sergeant, lieutenant, and then captain. And I retired in 2004 and immediately went up to the Catskill Mountains with my wife. And we lived a very Walden-esque lifestyle. We raised a lot of organic food. We have chickens for eggs. I heated my home with wood from my own woodlands. And it was a very peaceful lifestyle. But then this thing called the Occupy movement came along. I realized these kids were exactly right in condemning our government and the corporations. And I decided I had to help them.
So after you retired as police captain, you had a small hiatus from busy life, and then discovered you yourself were a political activist?
Well, it wasn't so, I guess you could say I discovered. I felt compelled, because these kids were being disparaged. And, they weren't just kids. And by the way, I don't want to disparage them by calling them kids, but when you're my age, anybody under 50 is a kid, all right? But I saw what the media was doing to them. And you have to understand, the media is owned by filthy, rich, white men who want to protect the status quo. They did not want white America to join in with this Occupy movement. So who did they interview at these protests? They interviewed the individuals with orange hair, with body piercings, with tattoos all over their body. I have nothing against any of that. I judge a person by their heart, by their actions. But mainstream media knew that white America, as soon as they saw these individuals, they would say, oh, that's not for me. I don't want to get involved in that Occupy movement, because they would not be able to relate to those people, some of those people involved in the Occupy movement. Mainstream media made it look like, hey, these are the people. You can't relate to them. Don't even think of joining this movement.
So you went down to the Occupy Wall Street encampment, and how did you lend your support?
Well, I lent my support basically by going up to the people and say, I'm here, use me in whatever fashion you want. I did not tell them this is what I'm going to do. This was their thing. I only appeared in a supportive role. And, well, what happened then is when somebody said, okay, you said it, we'd like you to come to a protest with us on Thursday morning. And I had got down there on Tuesday. I said, I'll be there. What time? He goes, 7. I said, 7 in the evening, right? No, 7 a.m. Hey, I've been retired for 8 years. I don't get up that early anymore. But anyway, hey, they wanted me up there at Wall Street at 7 a.m. I got there. I held a sign that said, NYPD, New York Police Department, don't be Wall Street mercenaries. In other words, they were protecting these banksters. And I went to that protest with that sign, and I was going to support them in uniform, because I know white America, if they see somebody in uniform protesting with the occupiers, it's going to give them some validity, because there's nothing more that white America respects than a white male police officer, let alone a captain. So anyway, I go there with that in mind, and I had no anticipation at all of getting arrested. None whatsoever. The thought never entered my mind. But then I saw these young kids being dragged away one after the other after the other, with their hands behind their back in these flexicuffs. And two things hit me right away, Sonalia. One is that these young people were willing to risk their freedom for who knows how long. They could have been put in jail for a day, a week, who knows, maybe a year. They did not know, but they were willing to risk that. Number two, what hit me was this protest happened just 3 days after the brutal destruction of Zuccotti Park by the NYPD. So they were also not only willing to risk their freedom, they were willing to risk their welfare, their physical welfare. They had no idea what would happen to them after they were taken out of view of the cameras. They could be brutally beaten. So these two things made me think, oh my gosh, they inspired me so much that I made the most spontaneous decision of my life. I put down my sign, I went out in the street, I sat down and I joined them in civil disobedience and not moving upon police command. I was then arrested for civil disobedience.
In full uniform? In
full uniform.
What impact did that have on you, and what, if any, possibly, on the police, on the NYPD?
The effect it had on me is documented in Time magazine and in video. While walking across that intersection, handcuffed, I felt just so many cheers, so many people supporting me with their voices, and I actually physically had goosebumps. And I will say this today, I said it 5 years ago, walking across that intersection handcuffed was the proudest moment of my life. And I've had a lot of proud moments. The impact it had on NYPD and all police, whatever city I go to, the one word I always hear is traitor, 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 always. And if you know anything about warfare, armies hate a traitor more than the actual enemy.
So after Occupy Wall Street, how have you seen your role, particularly in the last couple of years, when the issue of police brutality has inspired what many are calling the next biggest social movement we've seen since Occupy Wall Street, and that's Black Lives Matter?
Yeah, well, I'm involved in a lot of different type protests, basically where any injustice, major injustice, is being forced on people. I was in Indianapolis fighting for gay rights. I fight against Monsanto poisoning our food. I fight against fracking and pipelines. I have joined BLM marches, but I am not, people, especially police, think I'm totally about fighting police brutality. I am fighting that, but that's not what all I'm about. That's where police see me as a bad guy.
Well, you are dressed as a police, you're wearing your police captain uniform. Where do you land on that sort of discussion and debate around the relationship between police and the community, not just in those violent flashpoints that are caught on camera, but even in general?
Well, what you have to consider with police brutality, a couple of things. Number one, you greatly reduce police brutality by decreasing street crime. The way you decrease and almost eliminate street crime is to start arresting white-collar criminals who steal from the people, who steal from our schools, who take away health care, who take away jobs. This is what causes street crime, not someone with having black skin. You want to decrease street crime, fight poverty. You fight poverty by fighting the super filthy rich people in this country who oppress, discriminate, and exploit people. The second thing people have to realize about police brutality is, I'm going to give the other side, because it happened to me. I'll go right on record now. I've been on record already. I was a brutal cop. I was a brutal cop. I hit people with my nightstick too many times, more than I had to. What people have to realize is that police profession is so different from any other profession. And what I mean by that is, more than any other profession, a police officer is confronting hostility. Everywhere from constantly fighting, you go to a disturbance house where a wife calls on the husband, you break up a fight in the street, people are always fighting you. One of the reasons why, by the way, is because 99% of the time, one of them or both are inebriated. They're drunk. And when you're drunk, you're going to be fighting police much more than if you're not. So that's one reason. By the way, I never fought anyone who was high on marijuana. I never had to. They never fought me. But anyway, so police are constantly in these confrontations. We get called to evict people from their homes. Nobody wants to get evicted. Even a traffic ticket, something as simple as a traffic ticket, is a confrontation where you get hostility. People will spit out the window. They'll rip up the ticket. They'll say, why aren't you arresting drug dealers?
Do you think we're asking too much of police officers, too wide a spectrum of issues that they have to deal with, instead of things like, you know, social services dealing with it or mental health services dealing with some of these issues?
Well, police are highly placed in social work. They are answering calls for people who are laying in their feces, elderly laying in their feces and urine for 3 or 4 days, and they can't get help. They're called for child abuse when you see children terribly beaten up. They were the two things that bothered me most, child abuse and elderly abuse. But no, police can handle that. The police department, oh, by the way, you also have to have a social department. But the police are the initial ones on the scene, and then they contact the social workers. But police can handle that. One of the things has to happen is that the screening process, before a applicant ever steps into the police academy, the screening test, personality test given, it's called the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory Test, MMPI. It's the most widely used personality test in the world. Even corporations use it to filter out people that they don't think are going to stay with the job. I believe it's a good thing. You should have that test given. The trouble is it's being used incorrectly by most police departments. What they do is they screen out applicants who score too high on empathy, caring, sensitivity, because they don't think they'll be able to handle the blood and guts of the job. Those are the people you have to accept. People who score high in caring, empathy, and sensitivity. The other thing you have to screen out is people who score low in tolerance for disrespect. You better make sure people from that test score high in disrespect, because you're going to run into it. And the number one cause of police abuse starts with what they interpret as disrespect.
How do you view those police officers who've clearly violated all norms of ethics? You know, when you kick a person when they're down, shoot them in the back, or once they've been shot, leave them bleeding to death instead of giving them medical aid. I mean, how does it make you feel as an officer to see these fellow officers, if you will, behave in this way?
Well, as I'll extend my point I made earlier. I was one of those victims who violated, not victims, I was one of the perpetrators who violated those ethics. If you would have seen, if there would have been video cameras back when I worked, I would have been fired more than once. All right? I was one of those cops.
Why do you think that? And so, you mean, even if you say screen for empathy and stuff, you seem to be an empathetic person. Is there something about the job that brings out the worst in people?
Yes. As I explained earlier, you're constantly dealing with hostility. Therefore, you don't see people as people. You see them as problems, troublemakers. So that's all you see as people. People now are nothing but troublemakers. And you lose respect for that you don't see them as a person anymore.
How much crime would we eliminate as being defined as crime if we dealt with the fact that we live in a prohibition era when it comes to drugs?
The war on drugs is despicable. And I'll use the strongest word I can use to describe something in a negative way. The war on drugs is unconscionable. It's a moneymaker machine. It's always been a moneymaker machine. There is If we did not put millions and billions in fighting this drug war, we have actually invested trillions. And what for? To arrest people and lock them up. Taking drugs is an illness. It's an escape from reality. It's not a crime. You do not lock people up for having an illness that they need help. If we took that trillions of dollars and put it into addiction programs, if we put it into jobs, education, if we put it into counseling for these people that, hey, I don't have a purpose in life, I don't see a headway, hey, let's have free counseling for these people. Let's help them find purpose in life. The drug war has put so many good, productive citizens, potentially productive citizens, and productive. There's people in there that led productive lives, and they still were arrested. We have to change the whole paradigm there and start using that money for positive good and not for locking people up.
So do you think that we are getting to that point now? I mean, there are cities, there are states that are either considering it or have passed sort of certain types of legalization, specifically at least on marijuana. Yet our possibly new vice president, Hillary Clinton's vice presidential pick, Governor Tim Kaine, has a very poor rating from Normal, the organization that is spearheading marijuana legalization. So there seems to be a grassroots desire to really end this war on drugs, but it seems to be disconnected to what politicians and higher-ups want.
Sure, politicians, they're in office because of rich people donating money to them. One of the richest organizations that donate money to them are unions of cops and prison guards, and also these rich billionaires who build prisons. They want arrests for marijuana convictions. That way they keep their jails filled. That way cops have, there's plenty of need for cops to arrest these people. That's why there's plenty of need for a prison guard. It's all about money. It's always all about money. And these politicians, they don't want to get any resistance from these rich donors. They would much rather have some people shouting in the street, legalize marijuana. That's nothing. That's not risking their reelection or not risking them being elected. Shutting off their donor money is risking that.
Ray Lewis, thank you so much for spending this time with me.
Thank you, Sonali. My pleasure.
This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.